This morning's gospel reading is taken from chapter 16 of Luke's gospel. We've been going through Luke's gospel now since Advent. We're coming to the end of Luke's gospel for this year. This particular passage is one that offers a lot of challenges, major challenges in the light of who we are as people, as consumers, and as people who struggle to know the best way to live our lives as God would have it. This is a parable, and it has some attachments to it, which we will look at very shortly. Chapter 16. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his money. And so he summoned him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' Then the manager said to himself, 'What will I do now that my master is taking my position away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do so that when I'm dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes.' And so, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he answered, 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. Then he asked another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he replied, 100 baskets of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of the light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into eternal homes. Whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much, and whoever is dishonest in very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters, or a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." The word of the Lord. The parable is, as we said before, is really an invitation to go deeper in thought in terms of what Jesus may be offering. But I want to suggest, first of all, when they wrote this gospel, the parable really is the first 8 verses and then the last line, the last 13, verse 13. No slave can serve two masters, and whatever you love, you're going to serve, and what you hate, you're not going to serve. The stuff in the middle, this part here, "And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. Whoever is faithful in very little is faithful also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will entrust you?" I have no idea what any of that means. I really don't. It's the way the gospel is written. Sometimes when they when the subject came up, they took a lot of different sayings of Jesus that had pertinence to whatever they were discussing, and they threw it in there, really. And that's why the parable itself is those first 8 lines, and then the last, the last verse about not being able to serve two masters. That makes a little bit more sense. So we're just going to put that other stuff aside, because I have no idea what it means. The man is celebrated by Jesus. And Jesus says, it's very interesting that people who have to deal with people in the ordinary world are much more passionate about it than our children of the light. And Jesus is talking to his disciples. And what he is underscoring is the fact that if we look at the world around us, remember Jesus' world was the occupation of Rome, the domination of the Pharisees of the temple. Both were in collusion with each other, and it all had to do with money. Paying the tax to Rome and the Pharisees making sure that everybody paid their dues. That reality in Jesus' world called his attention to this very simple thing. That there's no loss of energy in the world of money-making. There's no loss of any kind of refocusing in a world of amassing wealth, whatever the wealth may happen to be in whatever culture. There's no energy that is not expended to do that because it is a major priority. In Jesus' day, remember that 90% of the people that Jesus spoke to were living in destitution. And as we saw in the example of last week or the week before, in the parable of the lost coin, when the woman who lost the one simple thing, a coin, she spent hours looking on the floor because that's the only thing that kept her from destitution, she and her family. And so it was extremely important for her to find that coin. And when she did find it, she had great joy because she realized we now are not going to be destitute. That's the world in which Jesus grew up. And Jesus was one of the people who was destitute. We don't often think of that. We have this image of Jesus being above all of that and somehow speaking for God from a place of security and peace and really having it all together. The man was struggling like everybody else to survive. And because he was Jewish, that survival took on a double load because of what the temple was doing on people by amassing their wealth at the cost and at the needs of the people who could not afford it in the first place. So when Jesus says, it really is sad, disciples, that there are people who are going to pursue that part of life to such a degree and do it with such passion, and we who are after the gifts of God don't expend anywhere near the kind of passion. And he's saying to his disciples, isn't it a sad thing? The second thing that I think is very important is that you can't serve God and money. Now, the text here says you cannot serve God and wealth. And if you go back through the centuries, this passage was translated into you cannot serve God and mammon. And mammon, I believe, studies I have done, mammon was a word that was used to euphemistically allow us to talk about money. Mammon kind of covered all the sins around money and greed, but it was something almost euphemistic. It seemed almost harmless. I mean, mammon. What? Go find me mammon. We're not threatened by mammon. However, when somebody says in a church, we now have to talk about the discrepancies between the realities of life and how money fits into the life of the church. That has been a bugaboo for centuries and centuries and centuries. And the poor people who have to stand up as stewardship people, and people like me and clergy that have to talk about these things, feel very much put out front with all the javelins pointing at us. Because there's no easy way to talk about money. There's no easy way around the whole discussion. But I'd like to throw out a couple of thoughts this morning that I think at least puts it in a perspective. I don't have any answers. I didn't understand the gospel. How am I going to have History shows us that in every generation, in every economy around the history of humanity, there has always been a discrepancy. When an economy or a culture is based on somehow possession of things and non-possession of things. The possessors of things from the very beginning of time have always been the ones in power because they had something that everybody needed. Now, back then, everybody was fighting to survive. It was a matter of life and death whether you ate. And so food was a big commodity. And if food could be provided for you, which was a luxury, then you had the respect of the rest of the world that had to grovel around and dig around in the holes to find stuff to feed their families. Go back to the very beginning. Well, that's gotten much more sophisticated over time. And we've gone through generational changes around money that have brought us to various places in life. St. Francis, in the middle of the 12th century, I believe it was 12th century, his father was very, very wealthy. He was a merchant of fine linens and fine cloth. And he made a fortune. And Francis was brought up in a very wealthy home. He needed nothing. He went off to the service, was honored as a man of the service of the military, came home to take his place as the future homeowner or the owner of this business that was worth a fortune. Francis encountered a situation in his life that changed his perspective. He saw that there were people who didn't have enough to survive. And he began to think, and his thoughts and the grace of God, we call it, brought him to a time when he confronted this whole situation, and he said, I can no longer be part of that picture. And I cannot, because I have seen something differently. And seeing something differently, he stripped off all of his clothes, everything that he had, he left it there and walked away and started to live the life of poverty. In fact, he thought poverty was, he called it lady poverty, because in that poverty, he found an experience of life that gave him what he believed to be the vision of God for the world. And that vision was something to do with looking at the structures of a culture and being able to say, we can do better than that, because it's not just those in power who should have, it is everybody that should have what they need. And Francis lived his whole life. In fact, there are monasteries all over the world that follow the Franciscan way, and they struggle to do the very same thing. Sometimes they succeed. Over the centuries, they've gone through four reformations because they got so far and got corrupt, and they went back to Francis and started over again, and they went back to Francis five times, and so there are five different orders of the Franciscans. The latest one, Friars of the Renewal, who live in the South Bronx, who live side by side and work side by side with the people of the South Bronx, which for a long time has been a hellhole in which to live. And they live among the people, they serve them, they give them education, etc., all for free. That's Francis. A model that was used throughout the centuries and periodically throughout the ages, we have found men and women who have come forward in their own life journey to say the very same thing, that there's got to be a change. Something has to be different. Now, change cannot take place, brothers and sisters, if we remember one thing. The consciousness that created the situation cannot be the same consciousness that tries to solve it. If this group of people or this way of thinking created the problems, this thinking cannot solve the problem, and it won't. In history, if we look at it honestly and objectively, history shows us over and over and over and over again, as many times as change has been tried or suggestions have been made or movements have taken place, it always takes a change of consciousness to effect the change. Change without a change of consciousness is not change at all. It is somehow a different version of what we have already accepted as real. We stamp and rubber stamp and rubber stamp that same picture over and over and over and over and over again throughout the millenniums. And that's very frustrating. When Jesus says you cannot serve God and money, what Jesus is talking about is precisely this. We know, all of us sitting here know, that there are people in the world who struggle for survival. We know that. We can't change that. That's a fact. Today it was on television that the latest study shows that 50 million Americans in this country have no idea where their next meal is coming from. 50 million Americans, not Somalis, not Afghanistan, not any of our enemies, 50 million Americans have no idea of where their next meal is coming from. Now, we all know that there are some people in that category who rush to our memories to remind us that, yeah, but there are a lot of takers too. A change of consciousness is what is called for, not a change of behavior, not another euphemistic step away from, or another explanation that remains the same, a change of consciousness. Gandhi said, and Gandhi has been immortalized by the wisdom of his life and his example. Certainly he had enemies, and certainly he didn't know everything, and he wasn't the wisest person on earth. But Gandhi listed 7 social sins, great, almost unforgivable social sins created by societies. One of them is to have wealth without the requirement for work. We'll leave that there. The more pertinent one to today is to have commerce, business, without morality. What is business without morality? We have in the last 10, 15 years, seen in our own country some of the huge corporations, some of the banking systems, some of the scandals that have been unearthed, the Bernie Madoffs of the world as individuals, and you know the corporations with investments and hedge funds and all the rest of it. We've seen it. A lot of us disagree with how it was handled. Some people still get upset when they realize those people that created that huge, world-shaking situation have never done jail time, or have gotten anything more than a slap on the wrist relative to what they had done. We have seen it, and the system has allowed it, and the system will continue to allow those things because you can't legislate morality. Nobody can tell me that it is wrong to do that. Nobody can tell me that's a sin. Nobody can tell us that it is not just, it is not fair, because in our culture, just and fair are decided by the powers that are. And the powers that are that own the system are not the 50 million who are struggling to find a meal for their family. They happen to be the ones who also have a lot of wealth, relative wealth. Not the $57 billion they own a year. All of us are in there. Because the truth is, brothers and sisters, and I have to go every time I buy something, it pops up. How is this produced? How does this impact the people who made this? Where did this come from? Do you know that 80, I don't know how many percentage, Jane could probably tell me the percentage, but a lot of the vegetables and fruits that we buy are not grown here in the United States. Not that we have to have everything grown in the United States, but just to be aware how the economy and how we live affects the world around us. Not just the world we can see, the world beyond the oceans, the worlds that we have never even known exist. We are one world. And if communication has done nothing, it's made us aware that just by turning on a television or clicking on a radio, we can be in Nairobi and see people shot down at a mall because the people are tired of the discrepancy between wealth and poverty. The greatest curse on this earth probably is poverty. In fact, Charles Dickens said it in his wonderful story about Christmas. Be afraid of ignorance and poverty. Because poverty generates an awful lot of feeling. It generates feelings that you and I would not ever want to have. And that's why we work so hard not to ever be in a destitute place. We grabbed hold of the American dream, and it has served us relatively well because we know at least we have a meal for today. Most of us have health care. Most of us have some kind of income, whether we work now or we have worked before for it. We have some income, we've planned, we had it. Most people in the world, brothers and sisters, don't even have that opportunity. The problem is not money. The problem is not the world's goods and wealth. The problem is how we have learned to accept the management of those things and have adopted a way of life with which we can live and be comfortable. I believe that what Jesus is saying here today, if indeed the consciousness that created the problems of our world today, they weren't ours, we inherited them, and it served us well. But we cannot expect the same consciousness that forms the government, that forms the politic, that forms the economic structures, that forms the possibility of investments, that handles health care, that deals with all the social workers and all the social work that's needed for people in so many different ways. We cannot expect that the consciousness that created all that bureaucracy and all those things with which we have learned to survive is ever going to come up with a different response than what we already have. It'll just be a tweak of the system and more of the same. Remember, I told you Jesus sometimes is the beautifully blossoming dandelion and a 500-acre manicured lawn stands out like a sore thumb and drives the owner crazy. Sometimes that Jesus, which by the way is why he was killed, had nothing to do with religion. Sometimes a person like Jesus has to be there to change the consciousness, or at least to offer the option. I'm not suggesting that any one of us is called to die to change our consciousness of the world. But as a person who tries to understand what it is that God intended from the very beginning, if there is a God, and God is responsible for creation, it would seem logical that the God we worship sees everybody the same and must scratch his or her head for centuries trying to figure out, why are there such inequities? Why is there such poverty on an earth that has such riches? Why are there just pockets of wealth and huger pockets of destitution? I don't have the answer. God doesn't have the answer. But the answer somehow lies, brothers and sisters, with each one of us changing our consciousness, not just accepting what is, but becoming ever more sensitive to the things we buy and why, the things we use and why, the amounts, the depth, the way we live, and the effect, indeed, it is having on the world around us, not just the world we see, but the invisible world beyond our sight. It's a hard message. It's not one that has easy answers, and I'm not suggesting I know the answer. All I'm saying is, I think, after listening for all these years, that I've learned that one thing. That's exactly, I think, what God had in mind. And it's my responsibility to do my little piece to somehow make a difference, I guess. That's why he called us to discipleship. Amen. This week, Pope Francis made some outrageous statements. I hope you heard them. Outrageous statements. Statements I never heard I would hear, never thought I would hear. Where he called upon the clergy and eventually all people to stop focusing on little issues and sifting out ways of keeping people away, but begin to be what Jesus intended, a place of inclusion of all people. And I thought, hey, after all these years, may he live to be 1,000. And affect that kind of change of consciousness. He's not changing the rules. He's asking for a change of consciousness. Because when it changes, things begin to change because we change. And I celebrated that this morning. I wonder how many people are celebrating the same Pope Francis when he made another statement yesterday. And said that the people of the world must take their focus off of making money and refocus on humankind. I just saw that at the bottom of the news this morning before we came. And I thought, how appropriate. Change of consciousness he's calling us to, not a change of more the same. Change the consciousness. You begin to change the world.